by Martin Handley.
Thank you very much indeed, James. Hello and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for what promises to be the first of two special evenings. The Vienna Philharmonic is not the world's oldest orchestra by a long way. It's generally reckoned it gave its first concert in 1842. It's never had a principal conductor, so nobody has moulded the orchestra. And yet, or perhaps because of that, the Vienna Phil is regarded as one of the world's very greatest bands.
There are different orchestra in many ways. It's very difficult to put your finger on it. Because they play opera and concerts, that puts a mark on the orchestra.
Yes, of course.
And because they're Viennese, they have this very special sound, which I can't explain in words. But it is the combination of the flexibility, the feeling so much at home with their own repertoire.
Bernard Haitink, one of the world's finest Brucknerians, who in the second part of tonight's BBC Prom conducts the Vienna Philharmonic in Bruckner's Ninth Symphony, the unfinished masterpiece which he intended to sum up his life's work. First, though, to make the complete dream team, orchestra and conductor are joined by Murray Pariah, a soloist in Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto. He composed it during one of the richest creative seams in his life, 2 or 3 years after 1804. Several of his major works from that period are about heroic struggle with much brow furrowing and fist shaking. But there's another group of pieces full of spacious lyricism, with the Fourth Piano Concerto sitting alongside the Pastoral Symphony and the Violin Concerto. What all Beethoven's instrumental music from those years does have in common is that it's written on an entirely new, large scale. But it's not just a matter of size. There's also a new boldness and originality, which is never more evident than at the very beginning of the concerto. In a completely new way, the piano begins alone, quietly and questioningly. When the orchestra answers, it's in a different key, as though from a different world. What follows is an enormous canvas, but one of confiding tenderness, in which, with its reflective understatement, the piano time and again challenges the orchestra's assertiveness. It's gradually appeased by the piano's eloquence in the slow movement, too. When harshness has been reduced to a ghostly whisper, the finale begins without a break with a quiet, march-tinged theme. There follows Haydn-esque swagger and playfulness, but again a still centre of rich lyricism. Bernard Haitink has the greatest admiration for Murray Pariah and told me you'd have to be made of ice not to be moved by his sincere, deep love for music. There are moments, he says, when he feels it's the composer himself playing. They've worked together for many years, not least on Beethoven, so does Murray Pariah know what to expect?
Sort of. But, you know, everybody's a different person 1 year hence. And so I'm counting on that. I'm a different person, he's a different person, and it'll be interesting how we interact. But I love working with Haitink. He's a wonderful conductor.
Murray Pariah. And here he comes. Closely followed by Bernard Haitink. Onto the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall. Joining the Vienna Philharmonic to perform Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto. Beethoven's fourth piano concerto, played here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, by Murray Pariah, with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Nothing more needs to be said. It was the concerto with which Beethoven appeared for the last time as a soloist in that immense and very under-rehearsed concert he gave in a freezing theatre in Vienna. A member of the audience on that occasion said the concerto was a work of prodigious difficulty, which Beethoven played with astounding skill at the fastest possible tempi. The slow movement of a beautifully developed song he positively made to sing on the instrument with a deep melancholy that thrilled me. I think you could say the same of tonight, not about the weather, but about the playing. Back comes Murray Pariah with Bernard Haitink a little behind him. Such a compact figure, Murray Pariah, giving little away as he plays. But you know every single note is thought about. And you can hear the reception. Bernard Haitink just letting Murray Pariah have his applause, now coming to the front and bringing the members of the Vienna Philharmonic to their feet. They'll be repeating this at the Lucerne Festival. And then Pariah's got a lot of recital tours in the autumn. In the States, though he starts off in Bremen. And then if you want to catch him in Cambridge on the 9th of November with St. Martin in the Fields, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, where he'll be directing late Mozart symphonies and playing late Mozart concerti. He was a young member of the Vienna Philharmonic who was not disbelieving when an older violinist colleague was demonstrating the promenader's thumping, which you've just heard. And the elder member said, "You just wait." Murray Pariah back on his own. Very youthful looking 65. Bernard Haitink said, "It's pure collaboration with Murray Pariah, and I treasure that." He said, "We don't need many words, we just get along." Murray Pariah, of course, New York born, but living in London, and it all started really exactly 40 years ago when he won the Leeds Piano Competition, which is going on today. Back he comes once more with Bernard Haitink following behind. And once more bringing the Vienna Philharmonic to its feet. As Bernard Haitink was saying, you can't really describe the sound of this orchestra, but if you listen, you know it's different instantly. Few words from Bernard Haitink to Rainer Kuchel, the leader, thanking the orchestra for their tremendous contribution too. Well, Bruckner intended his Ninth Symphony as a summing up of his life achievement. He didn't live to finish it, but the magnificent three movements he did complete form the second part of tonight's BBC Prom, in which the Vienna Philharmonic is conducted by Bernard Haitink. Rather loud announcement here in the Albert Hall. Well, first, during the interval here on Radio 3, we journey from Beethoven and Bruckner's Vienna to another distinctive European locale, and at a telling moment in history, as we find out in a classic tale by Stefan Zweig, Incident on Lake Geneva.
On the banks of Lake Geneva, close to the small Swiss resort of Villeneuve, a fisherman who had rowed into the lake one summer night in the year 1918 noticed a strange object in the middle of the water. When he came closer, he saw it was a raft made of loosely assembled wooden planks, which a naked man was trying to propel forward, using a piece of board as an oar. In astonishment, the fisherman steered his boat that way, helped the exhausted man into it, used some fishing nets as a makeshift covering for his nakedness, and then tried questioning the figure huddling into the corner of the boat. But he replied in a strange language, not a word of which was anything like the fisherman's. So the rescuer soon gave up any further attempts, pulled in his nets, and rowed back to the bank, plying his oars faster than before. As the early light of dawn showed the outline of the bank, the naked man's face too began to clear. A childlike smile appeared through the tangled beard around his broad mouth. He raised one hand, pointing, and kept stammering out a single word over and over again. It sounded like Rossia, and he repeated it the closer the keel came to the bank of the lake. At last the boat crunched onto the beach. The fisherman's womenfolk, who were waiting for him to land his dripping catch, scattered screeching when they caught sight of the naked man covered by fishing nets, and only gradually, on hearing the strange news, did several men from the village appear. They were soon joined by that local worthy, the courthouse usher, eagerly officious and very much on his dignity. He knew at once that this must be a deserter who'd swum over the lake from the French bank, and he was preparing to interrogate him. But any such process was deprived of dignity or usefulness by the fact that the naked man, to whom some of the locals had now thrown a jacket and a pair of cotton drill trousers, responded to all questions with his cry of, "Rossia! Rossia!" Slightly irked by his failure, the usher ordered the stranger to follow him by means of gestures that could not be misunderstood, and the wet, barefoot figure, his jacket and trousers flapping around him, was escorted to the courthouse, surrounded by the vociferous youths of the village who had now come along, and he was taken into custody there. News of this human catch had reached the nearby hotel, and several ladies and gentlemen, glad of this episode to relieve the monotonous course of the day's events, came over to look at the wild man. One lady gave him some confectionery, which he eyed as suspiciously as a monkey might, and did not touch. A gentleman took a photograph. They all chattered and talked as they swarmed around him, until at last the manager of the large hotel, who had lived abroad for a long time and knew several languages, spoke to the terrified man first in German, then in Italian and English, and finally in Russian. No sooner did he hear the first sound of his native tongue than the frightened man started violently. A broad smile split his good-natured face from ear to ear, and he was telling his whole story frankly and with self-assurance. In essentials, the man's history was as follows. He had been fighting in Russia, and then, one day, He and 1,000 others were packed into railway trucks and taken a very long way. They were transferred to ships and had travelled in those for even longer, through regions where it was so hot that, as he put it, the bones were baked inside your body. Finally, they were landed again, somewhere or other, packed into more railway trucks, and then they were suddenly told to storm a hill. But he knew no more about that, because a bullet had hit him in the leg as soon as the attack began. The audience, for whom the manager translated his questions and the man's answers, realized that this fugitive was a member of one of those Russian divisions fighting in France, who had been sent halfway round the world, from Siberia and Vladivostok to the French front. And as well as feeling a certain pity, they were all moved at the same time by curiosity. What could have induced him to make this strange attempt at flight? With a smile that was half good-natured, half crafty, the Russian explained that as soon as he was better, he had asked the orderlies where Russia was, and they had pointed to show him the way. He had roughly remembered the direction by noting the position of the sun and the stars, and so he had escaped in secret, walking by night and hiding in haystacks from patrols by day. He had eaten fruit and begged for bread for 10 days, until at last he had reached this lake. Now his account became less clear. Apparently he came from Lake Baikal, and seeing the undulating curves of the opposite bank ahead of him in the evening light, he had thought that Russia must lie over there. He had stolen a couple of planks from a hut, and lying face downwards over them, had used a piece of old board as a paddle to make his way far out into the lake where the fishermen found him. Could he get home tomorrow? By this time, a telephone call to Montreux had brought the arrival of a senior police officer to take down an account of the case. Rather an arduous task, for not only was the amateur interpreter's command of Russian inadequate, it was soon obvious that the man was uneducated to a degree scarcely comprehensible to Westerners. All he knew about himself was his own first name of Boris, and he was able to give only the most confused accounts of his native village. For instance, that the people there were serfs of Prince Machersky. He used the word serfs, although serfdom had been abolished long ago, and that he lived 50 versts from the Great Lake with his wife and 3 children. Now a discussion of what was to be done with him began, while he stood amidst the disputants, dull-eyed and hunching his shoulders. Some thought he ought to be handed over to the Russian embassy in Bern. Others feared that such a measure would get him sent back to France. The police officer explained the difficulty of deciding whether he should be treated as a deserter or as a foreigner without papers. The courthouse usher rejected out of hand any suggestion that the stranger should be fed and accommodated in Villeneuve itself. A Frenchman protested that there was no need to make such a fuss about a miserable runaway. He had better work or be sent back. 2 women objected strongly to this remark, saying that his misfortune wasn't his fault, and it was a crime to send people away from their homes to a foreign country. It began to look as if this chance incident would lead to political strife, when suddenly an old Danish gentleman intervened, saying that he would pay for the man's board and lodging for a week, and meanwhile the authorities could come to some agreement with the embassy. This unexpected solution satisfied both the officials and the private parties. During the agitated discussion, the fugitive's timid gaze had gradually lifted, and his eyes were now fixed on the lips of the hotel manager. He seemed to be vaguely aware of the turmoil caused by his presence, and as the noisy argument died down, he raised both hands in the silence and reached them out to the manager with the pleading look of women at prayer before a holy picture. This moving gesture had an irresistible effect on all present. The manager went up to the man and reassured him, saying that he had nothing to fear. He could stay here and come to no harm. He would have accommodation for the immediate future. The Russian tried to kiss his hand, but the other man withdrew it and quickly stepped back. Then he pointed out the house next door, a small village inn where the Russian would have bed and board, said a few more words of reassurance to him, and then, with another friendly wave, went up the beach to his hotel. The motionless fugitive stared after him. His glances followed the figure of the manager as he went away up to the hotel above the bank of the lake. When a sympathetic bystander touched him and pointed to the inn, his heavy shoulders seemed to slump, and he went to the doorway with his head bowed. The bar was opened for him. He sat down at the table, where the barmaid brought him a glass of brandy by way of welcome, and stayed there without moving all afternoon, his eyes clouded. The village children kept looking in at the windows, laughing and shouting something at him. He never raised his head. Customers coming in looked at him curiously, but he sat where he was, back bowed, eyes staring at the table. And when a crowd of guests came in to eat at midday and filled the room with their laughter, while hundreds of words he did not understand swirled around him, and he himself, horribly aware of being a foreigner here, sat deaf and mute amidst the general liveliness, his hands trembled so much that he could hardly raise the spoon from his soup. Suddenly, a large tear ran down his cheek and dropped heavily on the table. He looked timidly around him. The others present had noticed the tear and suddenly fell silent. And he felt ashamed. His large, shaggy head sank closer and closer to the black wood of the table. He sat like that until evening. People came and went. He did not notice them, and they had stopped noticing him. He sat in the shadow of the stove, like a shadow himself, his hands resting heavily on the table. He was forgotten, and no one saw him suddenly rise when twilight came and go up the path to the hotel, plodding like an animal. He stood for an hour at the door there, cap humbly in his hand, and then for another hour, not looking at anyone. At last, this strange figure, standing still and black as a tree stump, outside the sparkling lights of the hotel entrance, attracted the attention of one of the page boys who fetched the manager. Once again, his dark face lightened a little when he heard his own language. "What do you want, Boris?" asked the manager. "Forgive me," said the fugitive. "I only wanted... I wanted to know if I can go home." "Of course, Boris. To be sure you can go home." "Tomorrow?" Now the other man looked grave too. "No, Boris, not just yet. Not until the war is over." "When is that? When will the war be over?" "God only knows. We humans don't. But before that, can't I go before that?" "No, Boris." "Is it so far to go?" "Yes." "Many more days' journey?" "Many more days." "I'll go all the same, sir. I'm strong. I don't tire easily." "But you can't, Boris. There's a border between here and your home." "A border?" The word was new to him. "I'll swim over it." The manager almost smiled. "No, Boris, that's impossible. A border means there's a foreign country on the other side. People won't let you through." "But I won't hurt them. I threw my rifle away. Why wouldn't they let me go back to my wife if I asked them in Christ's name?" The manager was feeling increasingly heavy at heart. "No, they won't let you through, Boris. People don't take any notice of the word of Christ any more." "But what am I to do, sir? I can't stay here. The people that live here don't understand me, and I don't understand them." "You'll soon learn, Boris." "No, sir." The Russian bowed his head. "I can't learn things. I can only work in the fields. That's all I know how to do. What would I do here? I want to go home. Show me the way." "There isn't any way at the moment, Boris." "But, sir, they can't forbid me to go home to my wife and my children. I'm not a soldier any more." "Oh, yes, they can, Boris." "What about the Tsar?" "There's no Tsar any more, Boris. He's been deposed." "No Tsar any more?" He stared dully at the other man. The last glimmer of light went out in his eyes. "So I can't go home?" "Not yet. You'll have to wait, Boris." Boris was twisting his cap in his hands. "Then why do they take me away from home? They said I had to fight for Russia and the Tsar, but Russia is far away from here. And the Tsar, what do you say they did to the Tsar?" "They deposed him." "Deposed? What am I to do, sir? I have to go home. My children are crying for me. I can't stay here. Help me, sir. Help me." "I just can't, Boris. Can no one help me?" "Not at the moment." The Russian bent his head even further. "Thank you, sir." He turned away. He went down the path, very slowly. The hotel manager watched him for a long time and was surprised when he did not go to the inn, but down the steps to the lake. He sighed deeply and went back to his work in the hotel. As chance would have it, it was the same fisherman who found the drowned man's naked body next morning. He had carefully placed the trousers, cap and jacket that he had been given on the bank and went into the water just as he had come out of it. A statement was taken about the incident, and since no one knew the stranger's full name, a cheap wooden cross was put on the place where he was buried, one of those little crosses planted over the graves of unknown soldiers that now cover the continent of Europe from end to end.
Dermot Crowley was reading Incident on Lake Geneva by Stefan Zweig, translated by Anthea Bell. The producer was Duncan Minchell. Welcome back to an absolutely packed Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, to the second part of tonight's BBC Prom, live here on Radio 3. And the one work on the programme is Bruckner's unfinished Ninth Symphony. And on the platform to perform it will be one of the great orchestras of the world, the Vienna Philharmonic, described by Bruckner as the most superior ensemble. I asked Bernard Haitink whether when he was conducting Bruckner with them, it all just fell into place.
Yes, I said to them, you are really, for Mr. Bruckner, the best proposition. You are really a Bruckner orchestra. And they love it, and that is the touching thing of them. They listen, and that is their world. It's very strange.
There's all this pain, spiritual anguish that we haven't heard before, have we, in Bruckner, really?
Well, the eighth comes closer to it already, but the ninth is very special. And one should not make comparisons with the end of life, and then after that couldn't compose anymore. No, he couldn't compose because he died. He wanted to compose a finale very much, and there's a great loss, great sadness that he couldn't complete it. But one has to accept that and not mess around. And this idea of different composers trying their hand on it, I really don't like that.
Despite that, these three incredible movements that we have, is it still the summation of his life's achievement that he wanted it to be?
Could be. It is his most advanced work. It shows the way to the new Viennese school, in a way. It's wonderful, very gripping.
Bernard Haitink. Bruckner's spiritual core was defined by his experiences of religion and nature. For him, the fundamental purpose of his life was to glorify God. He'd grown up beneath the Austrian Alps, and their stillness and majesty permeate his music, all the more so because for him, nature was an expression of God's divinity. Bruckner was one of the finest organists of his day. He gave a recital on the organ here in the Albert Hall the year it was opened. His symphonies contain massive blocks of sound, and changes of texture sound like a change of organ registration. In failing health, he worked on his Ninth Symphony for 9 years and was still working on it the day he died, though during that time his insecurity caused him obsessively to revise his earlier symphonies too. That insecurity and his personal loneliness made him very vulnerable. His need for order and his Catholic faith hid something unstable, even chaotic, which appears more clearly than ever in this last music. The monumental first movement has an otherworldly intensity, seeming a portent of death, maybe, rather than his usual Brucknerian hymn of thanksgiving. The extraordinary scherzo seems doom-laden too. There's nothing of the Austrian country dance of earlier symphonies here. The composer Robert Simpson writes of it that the music compels and repels as it snakes across the scene. There is nothing like it elsewhere in the composer's music. And as for the slow movement, in its own way, it provides a real conclusion to the officially incomplete work, a movement full of rich but subdued orchestral colour. Maybe a song of farewell to life. much more packed Albert Hall platform now, as you can imagine. Always great to see when the horn players also bring on the Wagner tubas with them. Careful as they mount the steps not to trip and let a valuable brass instrument roll down. And all is ready for Bernard Haitink returning to the Royal Albert Hall platform and joining the Vienna Philharmonic to conduct Anton Bruckner's Ninth Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you.
A Song of Yearning, at the end of which heaven's gates open, was how Bruckner's editor described that final adagio of his unfinished Ninth Symphony. And the composer himself referred to the Wagner tuba writing in that movement as his departure from this life as it gently ebbed away. And the symphony was performed here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, to end the first of this evening's two BBC Proms by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, concertmaster Rainer Kuchel, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Back comes Bernard Haitink. You kind of almost see the ghostly figure of Anton Bruckner on the organ stool, and you hope he would hear this reception for the culmination of his life's work. An incredibly vigorous, vital octogenarian on the podium tonight. And he may have had the score in front of him, but it never moved from the first page. Going round all the string players, saluting the first desks, very much, as always, in the middle of his orchestra, not out on the front. Well, Bruckner left some 200 pages of sketches for the finale. Some say he was working on the very last pages when he died. Some of those appear to have been taken by souvenir hunters. Nonetheless, the sketches have recently been realised. Bernard Haitink, however, as he said, sticks with the three movements, saying you have to respect life, but you also have to respect death. If you've just come back, caught the end of that performance, then I'm sure you may well want to catch it on the iPlayer, and you can hear it for the next week. And the horns being brought to their feet. Listen to that noise. And the heavy brass. Hopefully the Wagner tubas. And the wind. Well, even without the finale that Bruckner just couldn't complete, his Ninth Symphony is still an extraordinary and magnificent piece. The Vienna Philharmonic and Bernard Haitink, as you can hear, have enthralled the Albert Hall with their performance of it here this evening. Personally, I can't wait for more from this great combination, so join me at 7:30 tomorrow evening when we juxtapose Haydn's final great symphony of the London with Richard Strauss's celebration both of the mountains of Bavaria and of life, his Alpine Symphony. But for now, it's time I handed you on to James Jolly at Broadcasting House to guide you through the rest of your Radio 3 evening. James.
Thank you, Martin. That was Martin Handley at the Royal Albert Hall. And we return to the Royal Albert Hall later this evening for a prom given by the Congolese street band Stuffbender Bilili. That's at 10:15. Well, we've a little time before our next programme, Hungary's Soul, Liszt and Gypsy Music, so I thought we'd hear them from members of this evening's prom orchestra, the Vienna Philharmonic, and their former first harp, Xavier de Maistre. Here's Debussy's Two Dances for Harp and Strings.
Thank you.
Debussy's Danse Sacrée et Danse Profane for harp and strings, played by Xavier de Maistre with members of the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. And you can hear the Vienna Phil in tomorrow's prom at 7:30, Bernhard Haitink again conducting Haydn's last symphony, number 104, the London, and after the interval, Richard Strauss's Mighty Alpine Symphony. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Now another chance to hear a feature first broadcast on the 200th anniversary of Liszt's birth last year. The Hungarian-born poet George Surtees returns to Budapest to uncover the myths surrounding Liszt's relationship with gypsy music. He begins in the house of Bálint Sarosi, Kodály's last living student, listening to field recordings of gypsy music.
With a guitar. Gypsy song. What has it? To dance. Gypsy dance music. Gypsy, original gypsy. I recorded it in a restaurant. That is a simple melody. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Gypsies are playing and people in the restaurant are singing. You can hear the difference. What is the song melody and what is transforming into instrumental music.
I'm standing in Fisherman's Bastion. That is the 19th century fantasy castle on top of the hill in Budapest, where I first came in 1984 on my first return visit. I'm looking out over the Danube, which is grey on this day. But I've come here to Budapest to try and rediscover something. On that first occasion, I came here and we sat down in a restaurant, myself and my wife, and there was a gypsy band playing. A man began to play. He did the usual sort of thing. He came to the table. He saw my wife and leaned close to her ear and started playing. They play tunes which I recognized. They are tunes which my parents knew. They are tunes which they found in Liszt. They found them in the rhapsodies. They found them in the songs. They found them in Brahms. And they had what they thought was a raw material. And that meant the world to them. It was real music. What I'm here to do now is to find out how real it was. It's the 200th anniversary of Liszt's birth, and the most appropriate thing is to come here and find out what Liszt found. He wrote a book about it, after all. He wrote a whole book called Gypsy Music in 1859. He wrote it in French because he couldn't speak Hungarian. I want to follow the book, and I want to follow the clues that lead from the book as to what he meant by gypsy music, what might be meant by gypsy music by other people, and what is it about all of this that is or is not Hungarian, that which so moved my parents and which moved me too in that restaurant, where when the music began to play, despite myself, I found myself in tears. Before I got to Budapest, I spoke to the concert pianist, Leslie Howard, the great exponent of Liszt's works.
Is it Liszt who coins the term gypsy music?
I don't know of it before him, and he is quite specific about referring to it as gypsy music in his book. I know he calls it Zigeunermusik in German. This, of course, raises immediately the question of what's gypsy music and what's Hungarian folk song and whether Liszt had the slightest idea about one or the other.
Well, people often point out that his book isn't necessarily as authoritative as it might be.
He wasn't an ethnomusicologist, so it's rather useless to expect him to be like Béla Bartók was, although Bartók is one of the people who actually defended Liszt's book, because he maintained that all you had to do was sensibly detach one thing from the other and then you could understand what he was talking about. Liszt's book doesn't say it's about Hungarian folk song, but Liszt does use Hungarian folk songs in some of his pieces. And the question really is just where he heard them, but I think most of what Liszt heard was played by gypsy bands. And I don't think he ever heard too many unaccompanied washerwomen singing in the countryside. He didn't go out to look for Hungarian songs like that, but he certainly knew lots of groups of performing musicians.
The bells you can hear are the bells of Old Buda. I am standing at the entrance of the Institute of Musicology, a part of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. I'm about to talk to Katalin Kowalczyk, an expert on Roma and Gypsy life. Why did Liszt feel he had to write this book about Gypsy music?
When Liszt wrote the third series of the Hungarian Rhapsodies, he asked Marie Dago to write a short introduction, but she didn't do it. And later, the new companion of Liszt, Caroline Sen-Wittgenstein, started to write this introduction. And the specialists of Liszt think that most part of the book was written by her and not by Liszt. But the specialists think that Liszt agreed with the text of Caroline Sen-Wittgenstein, and they published it on the name of him. He wanted to glorify Gypsy life because he had a new way of composing. And there was this romantic ideal about Gypsies, that they are free and they are the children of the nature. And Liszt, as a romantic composer, wanted to show himself as free. And that's why he could find connection with the life of the Gypsies that was positive.
We're sitting in the lovely office of Peter Suhai, who is the curator of the exhibition about Liszt and Gypsy life and Gypsy music here at the Ethnographic Museum in Budapest. And Peter is the man who puts the exhibition together. Peter, what is the connection between Liszt and Gypsy music?
It seems that Liszt had been acquainted with Gypsy music from early childhood and had always been as excited by the idea of Gypsy life, that is to say, as far as he understood it from books, as by the music itself. Some people think that Liszt identified with Gypsies and their nomadic lifestyle because he himself was constantly on the move. He also saw a close and exciting resemblance between the way Gypsies performed and he himself performed.
Which musicians did Liszt actually know personally?
We know all that from his books, where he writes about Gypsies, or rather about those Gypsies who made an impression on him. The Gypsy violinist about whom he writes at greatest length is János Bihari.
So when Liszt became acquainted with these Gypsy musicians, did he meet them in the town? Did he meet them in the countryside?
Liszt was born in Nagy Dobrunja, now a part of eastern Austria. That's to say, in the western part of what had once been Hungary. He couldn't speak Hungarian, but many Gypsies were employed at aristocratic courts in the region. There were, for example, various branches of the Esterházy family nearby. The first Gypsies served as musicians at such courts. Within a 50-kilometer radius, you had Vienna and Pozsony, the current Bratislava, and also Galánta. Well-known Gypsy musicians do, to some extent, become part of Hungarian society. The gentry, the landed aristocracy, can't have a party without Gypsy musicians to entertain them. On the other hand, they are fully documented incidents, such as the story of Baron Rogai, who, when he took a fancy to it, would set his Gypsy band to climb the trees and serenade his guests from there. In other words, the Gypsy musicians, though likely to be showered with money, remain subservient and likely to be humiliated. We shouldn't see their condition through rose-tinted glasses.
The gypsies become representatives of Hungarian national identity through the first 30, 40 years of the 19th century. But when Liszt is a young man and he's going around the courts, before it becomes a really national music, what would he have been hearing then?
Ezt a zenét játszották, de azért, mert cigányok játszották, ezért nem cigányok.
Liszt did hear gypsies playing, but what they played was not gypsy music. What Liszt argues in his book, which surprises his contemporaries, was that gypsies played the music that they had brought with them from India. What they were actually playing was tunes composed by Hungarians in the 18th century, mostly of the kind we call verbenkos, recruiting music, which is a complex form involving some Turkish elements. The important thing is that at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th, we see a conscious effort to establish a characteristically Hungarian music.
Megteremtik a magyar zenét.
But what is Hungarian music? Liszt talks of happening upon gypsy musicians in rural settings. But the gypsies he names were mostly employees of aristocratic courts in the orbit of Vienna. Who were the court gypsies? How did they get there? Where did they come from? And whose music were they playing? In other words, whose music was Liszt adapting and turning into Hungarian music? Bálon Sárasi is the only living pupil of Kodály and has written extensively about Hungarian gypsy music. When Liszt heard the gypsies playing, where did they get their music from?
At the end of the 18th century. It was at that time the national movement. And as here in Hungary, we did not have such music than in Austria, Beethoven and Haydn and Mozart. We had nothing Hungarian, only the traditional music played in villages. They had to raise such gypsies, and the best of them had to learn something about the fashionable music, that means the classical music. So, at the end of the 18th century, the best gypsy bands were helped out in the aristocratic courts. They could not learn the score. It was too difficult, but they were accustomed to learn quickly by ear. And at the beginning, also in the time of Liszt, there were very few such ensembles. But as they were the representatives of the Hungarian music, they could attach to the Hungarian national music, and they remained entertainment musicians on the peasant level, first of all. These musicians had to represent the Hungarian spirit were already at that time assimilated. Much of them could not speak at that time already gypsy. They are Hungarian.
Yes, but there is still much to learn about the gypsies and the way they developed from poor village entertainers to gypsy kings. What is becoming clearer is that in working with what he called gypsy music, Liszt was trying to create something identifiably Hungarian to go with a rising tide of national feeling. That feeling was to lead to the 1848 revolution and beyond. But isn't it fascinating that he should have turned to the style developed by gypsies from Verbunkos and Csárdás in order to present the Hungarian character? The gypsy musician he most praises is János Bihari, direct seventh-generation ancestor of the living gypsy virtuoso Robi Lakatos.
János Bihari, he was the famous violin player in our family. He was the Hungarian Paganini.
But do you know how Liszt met Bihari?
I think it's absolute in Vienna, because he was the gypsy violin player and the orchestra by Franz Joseph in the Habsburg time, and Liszt played there, of course, a lot of time. And then he meet there, and then I think he's coming a very good friend. And the more interesting, all 21 Hungarian Rhapsody, list is right, the main theme came from Bihari.
What Bihari János was playing, was he playing his original compositions, or was he setting tunes, folklore music that he found amongst Hungarian people?
This is the way from the gypsy, because when a gypsy came first time in the 13th century in Europe, all gypsies going in different countries. And the musician, it's taken the local folklore music from there. Like a Hungarian stay in Hungary, so the Hungarian gypsy play the Hungarian folklore music. So this is a gypsy style, because the gypsy is not learning the violin, so it's absolute authentic, so it came from the esprit, really. Gypsy style, of course, he was play the violin with a lot of glissando, and the vibrato is absolutely different. So I just know some small theme in my head. It's a kind of rhapsody from Liszt. So this is the main theme from from Bihari, the gypsy version, so the Csárdás version is just like this.
So what do you think of Liszt's arrangements of the original tunes?
It's fantastic. I love very much all Hungarian Rhapsody, and the most famous is the second. In this Rhapsody, there is Csárdás, there is all kind of style, but really, really Hungarian gypsy music style. I love very much.
The period after the dramatic failure of the revolution was a time of mourning. People wanted consolation. The sweet, sad music provided by the gypsies, a form of celebrating by weeping, led to the rise of the nauta, the sentimental lament whose energy was fed by the kind of grandeur and melancholy found in European Romanticism generally, but given a particularly keen interpretation by gypsy musicians. It was as if Hungarians had said to the gypsies, be us, speak for us, if only in music. Hungarian spirit was fast becoming synonymous with gypsy music, not only at home, but abroad too. Simon Broughton is the editor of world music magazine Songlines and has travelled widely in Hungary in search of gypsy musicians.
I don't think there was any official attempt to sort of brand Hungary as the country of gypsy music. But I think in the 19th century, it was just an image of the country that writers drew on, that composers drew on, and artists drew on. Indeed, that exhibition in the Ethnographic Museum, you just see what a regular theme it was in art, a romanticised idea of these itinerant, music-loving gypsies. I think it does relate to the idea of the noble savage, which was also a popular concept. I mean, in the gypsies, you have people who are unpredictable, uncontrollable, subversive. So there's an appealing sort of danger around them. And certainly you get that in operetta, which became hugely popular towards the 19th century, early 20th century, what they called Silver Age operetta, composers like Lehár and Emmerich Kallmann. Ich bin ein Zigeunerkind, lieb und hass wie keiner. Ruder Rest, ich nirgends dient. Ich bin ein Zigeuner.
Hogy Liszt
Liszt saw gypsies as an exotic people. The fact that he attributes the nation's music to the gypsies, who he believes brought this music out of India, shows his admiration of gypsies. In fact, he is almost unique in not speaking of gypsies in a patronizing or pitying way. He is living in a time that is greatly fascinated by exoticism, by what we now call Orientalism.
When Liszt wrote his book, it was at least partly intended to serve as an introduction to a new kind of music, his own Hungarian rhapsodies.
The book offered a musical, cultural, ethnic, and spiritual guide. But how far did it describe the actual lives of gypsies? How important was it to them? Did it raise their social prestige? Or was it yet another case of exoticism, imposing an interpretation on a powerless subject?
It's very easy to criticise Liszt for getting lots of things wrong in his book. I think more important is the fact that he did really like this music and was really impressed by it. And doing what he did with it, which is essentially put it onto a classical concert stage, he did get people to notice it who wouldn't otherwise have encountered or been interested in this music. So it did give it an air of respectability.
Hungarian people was very scandalised. Where from thinks Liszt that this music belongs to gypsies? Even if it was virtuoso music, it was harmonized with Liszt's taste. And he did not control where from the gypsies have these melodies. He see the gypsies playing without score. And also how the gypsies transposed simply song melody into instrumental music is not difficult. That was already something original to Liszt.
What was the attitude of the gypsies to Liszt?
There was one gypsy in the 1860s, Farkas, his name, hearing that Liszt says that this is the music of the gypsies, he said in a newspaper, "I'll go to Liszt and tell him the truth."
Marta Shevchenko is known all over the world as a folk singer. I'm meeting her on an afternoon of heavy rain in a busy cafe right opposite the opera. She too has her ideas on authentic gypsy music.
The gypsies, they have a quite different music of their own. Their ethnic music is just vocals and all these effects like this, or the aluminium jug. Yeah? So there is nothing to do with all these violins. It's just a romantic image that, aha, in Budapest, in every corner, you meet a guy in a red vest and with a violin. Sorry, but I think Liszt, the misunderstanding, when he heard these melodies, he thought they were Hungarian melodies and he used them in his work. They weren't really the Hungarian melodies. But if there was somebody to lead him to the traditions, then he could be our first folk music collector, and I wish I could be an MP3 player in his pocket. And I'm fantasizing always how wonderful material was lost or being recorded.
There are basically two broad groups of gypsies in Hungary, and they play very different music and they have a very different history. So there's what's called the Romongro gypsies, who are largely Hungarian-speaking, have been settled in Hungary much longer. And this is the music that one associates with gypsy music in restaurants, the sort of music that influenced Liszt in his Hungarian rhapsodies. Now, that style, having been hugely popular really up until the end of the communist period, has declined a lot in Hungary. But what's taken its place is a different sort of music played by the Ola gypsies. The word actually is an old Hungarian word for Romanian. And these gypsies came much later in the middle to late 19th century. After slavery was abolished in Romania, gypsies in Romania were slaves until the mid-19th century. And then when they were freed, a lot came to Hungary. They tend to be the Romani-speaking gypsies, and they're much more rural in their lifestyles.
I'm standing right in front of the music academy that Liszt founded together with Erkel in the middle of the 19th century. In fact, it's right opposite the block I lived in before we left this country in 56 after the revolution. There's a photo of me as a child at the side of the building. A year or two after the photograph was taken, I auditioned, unsuccessfully, for a place there as a child pianist. Almost every well-known musician and music historian has passed through these doors, including the great gypsy cimbalom player, Kálmán Balogh.
highest point of the gypsy music was in the 1920s and before that. But after the Second World War, slowly the people, they still loved the gypsy music and the songs, but there was a kind of cultural thinking like that is not real folk music. Bartók and Kodály, they don't hate the gypsy music, just they wanted to say, don't have a mistake. The gypsy music is fantastic, but is not the real Hungarian folk music. Many people try to discover what is really the national identity in the music. And Bartók and Kodály, they told, you can find the real basic things on the land between the peasant people, in the village especially. In the folklore, you are not in style if you are too expressive. Example, there is a very famous melody. Only one girl is on the world. Csak egy kislány van a világon. You can find it in the folklore, but it's so different how in the village peasant will sing you and how the gypsy will play you and how the singer in the city will sing for you. You can do it like Csak egy kislány van a világon. Ja, da, 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 da. If coming here is a primash, he will do that. The band play. What we are talking about now, that is the city style, what is really romantic and very dramatic and expressive. But when we are talking about village gypsy musicians who are playing for peasant people far from the other culture, they are playing very simple. The people on the earth, there you can find really the spirit of the nation. The gypsies who are not musicians, their folk music is again folk music, is not something theatrical. Even today you can find different groups between the gypsies. Outside from the cities, in small village or out from the villages, there are still some communities who have their own music, songs, dances, and that is folklore.
You can show the difference between three kind of Hungarian gypsy music. The original normal gypsy music, the gypsy heritage. Then we have the so-called gypsy music, which has nothing to do with gypsy culture. And we have the Hungarian instrumental folk music, where also gypsies are the best musicians. But this is not called gypsy music. This is instrumental folk music, dance music, yes.
What was a typical ensemble in a Hungarian village before the gypsies? What were the instruments?
In the old times, there were no ensembles. Even when the gypsies came here, they wandered in twos. One made the melody, another made some accompaniment, bagpipe music, flute music. For simple people, it is enough one instrument.
When the Hungarians welcome Liszt and they want to show him what we can do, this is Hungarian music, they don't think of going to villages and hearing people playing bagpipes.
He expressed his wish to go around in Hungary and collect music. But with Liszt's taste, they could not collect original Hungarian peasant music. It was too primitive for him. This is not music. It was not music for a romantic ear.
Liszt in his book describes a visit to a gypsy encampment and a fete. This is what he says. A fete was offered to us, which took place in the woods. It was in the month of October, the sun rays having still some force and spreading a slight sensation of warmth. A great banquet had been prepared for some hundreds of peasants, gathered together from various surrounding villages, all belonging to the same landlord, who had selected this day for the purpose of making good to them a year's taxes. That was written back in 1859. But what is village life like now? And what of the music? I'm setting out on Liszt's tracks to find out how life has changed in the intervening century and a half, through two world wars and communism, to now. Well, I've travelled across the Great Hungarian Plain, 3 hours from Budapest to Nyíregyháza, country city, and then in a car, about another half an hour, through ever poorer villages, down to Pasab, which is where the band Parnograst, which means white horse, where they started, where they live, and where we're going to hear them play. Well, how did Parnograst start, József?
Konkrét indulás az 2000.
Properly speaking, we started in 2000 when we made our first album. But long before that, in our childhood, we had this urge to make music together. It was in our blood.
Are there some old traditional songs?
Naturally, there are old songs. You see how we brought the old man along. We stole a lot of things from him that we adapted to our own style. And besides that, I write a lot of new songs so that there should be new material, stuff that we ourselves write.
What was life like before the Parnograst, and has it changed at all?
I think life then was much as now. Life hasn't changed much for the band, apart from the fact that we have travelled to a lot of places and seen the world. But in other respects, things are much as they were. And if you ask me, that is the chief strength of Parnograst, that we've been around 10 years and people say, in 10 years, we haven't changed a bit, and that our fourth album is exactly the same as our first.
What does Parnograst think of the kind of music that is played by gypsies in Budapest cafes and restaurants?
We call them city gypsy musicians. We are, I suppose, village gypsy musicians. And in villages, it's pretty rare to find a violinist. I hardly know any violinists around here. They tend to be educated musicians, while people like us, in villages, have never really studied music. We play by heart and by ear, whatever rocks the place. What I say is, all respect to my fellow musicians uptown, because we go on tour abroad and people say, that's great, but where's the violin? There's no violin. But this is not that kind of music. We have a tambourine. We are village gypsy musicians. There are not many violinists among us. We play guitars.
I went to Pasab and spent time there around Easter, and there was a particular day when they went playing music in everybody's house.
So Parnograst, within their community, are they seen as a professional band who people hire out for occasions? Or are they people who do, just as you have described, going from house to house because that is their vocation in some way and everybody says, come along and play?
They do play local gigs as a local band. So if someone's having a wedding, they would certainly book that band. What's happened, interestingly, over the last probably less than 10 years is Parnograst has gone from being really a village only known in their region to also being a band that has an international reputation.
In that process in which Parnograst go from being a grassroots band where they are and they become stars, is this one of the natural processes for people like Parnograst? In a way, they're re-entering the mainstream in some ways as their predecessors had done.
I think this has always happened with musicians. It's the aspiration of many musicians to, first of all, serve your own community in a traditional way. But, of course, then it's great to be recognised outside that community and to go and play abroad, and of course it offers much more financial rewards.
All this while I've been speaking about gypsies and gypsy music, because that is what Liszt did. And the musicians we have spoken to have themselves traded under the gypsy label. But as a people, we should call them Roma. It is the Roma whose interests Agnes Ostojkan represents. She is, in fact, the first female Roma representative elected to the Hungarian parliament. She was born in a village near Parnograst in the Satmár region of northeast Hungary. Here, in the Hungarian parliament, she's fighting particularly for the education of young Roma and regularly sees the poverty of rural communities.
I think the musician life is disappeared in the rural things. And, you know, between the Roma people, if we speak about the musicians, we are always thinking that kind of old people who just playing like nota in the cafe house. That kind of people always lived a different, higher level of life.
Parnograst, they've made world tours, they have released albums, so they must have some economic benefit from this. They live in a village where they have 200 relatives. The house is still exactly as it was. There's nothing particularly modern in it, just a relatively poor but well looked after house. So here's a band which travels abroad, which makes some money. How far do you think it has changed their life or their community's life?
Because they are started to be famous.
Yes, so they actually have some money which they can use. They could choose to improve the house.
Do you think that they earn money that they can change their life? I think they cannot achieve their goals during Hungary do not recognize that they are part of the Hungarian culture.
The music of modern village gypsies like Parnograst is as far a cry from the heyday of 19th century gypsy music as their social status is from that of gypsy royalty. Different too from the continuation of that tradition through the first half of the 20th century with its smart cafes and restaurants, let alone the courts and concert halls of the Biharis and the Lakatoshes. Was there a decline through the wars and communist period? Was there a loss of popularity? And if so, when and why?
At the second part of the 19th century, this urban music, so-called gypsy music, came to the villages too. It was a means for the integration of the peasants. And after the Second World War, there was a partly idealistic but very positive thinking of the specialists that school children must learn folk music. That means that folk music was decided more valuable than the urban music. And the problem was that that was an idea to bring peasant music to schools and to the musical life of the society. But the other aspect of this problem was that it was bright in opposition of urban music, of gypsy music.
We can crudely identify two stages under the new communist regime. In 1945, the land was divided up and there were no longer estates over 100 acres. The gypsies' chief employer, the great landlord, no longer existed, nor did the landed peasantry. And this restricted their options and led to abject poverty. In 1961, the party's central committee decided to improve the lot of gypsies and set out a program. The socialist industrialization of the country required an extraordinary amount of labor, and the unemployed agricultural gypsies were taken to the cities to become part of the workforce. The ex-violinist, or cymbala player, was trained to be an industrial worker. In 1985, the then Hungarian government realizes that they have a lot of loss-making industries, superfluous mines and steelworks, etc. The first people to go are the unskilled workers, and this means chiefly the gypsies. Without being cynical, you might compare this to the old system where the gentry kept gypsies' musicians in poverty, so they should remain dependent. In this case, the state contrived to maintain a large, minimally skilled, dispensable workforce that could be moved about at will.
So is there an attempt by gypsy musicians to preserve the kind of music they are playing? Do they have a sense of tradition that should be maintained?
In the 60s, when there was full employment and the gypsies moved into workers' hostels, the hostels became a melting pot of various strands of gypsy life. Here, the Ola gypsies started to develop a folk-based music that was not, in fact, folk music. New instruments appeared in the hostels, most importantly, the guitar. In the old system, whenever rural Ola gypsies, but Hungarian gypsies too, for that matter, got together, there had been four means of making music: finger-clicking, the chair used as a drum, the spoons, and the metal milk churn. No proper instruments. The whole was built round the human voice. It became the basis of the new music, which soon employed instruments. So, they developed a gypsy folklore music that has become identified with universal gypsy music, the kind played by Pano Grast. It is this that gypsies actually began to listen, forgetting the violin, cymbalum, bass and clarinet. There was one more change to come. Ola gypsies used to look down on musician gypsies because they catered to peasants and the gentry, while musician gypsies looked down on Ola bands because they couldn't play proper instruments. But the last 15 years have seen an attempted synthesis between the two kinds of music. Two strands of music combine under the broad terms of what we call world music.
So what have I learned? That the urban music list called gypsy music was in fact Hungarian music, interpreted by educated gypsy professionals. That Liszt's book might not have been written by Liszt. Well, not entirely. That the poor rural gypsies, who were not musicians, had a hard life. And that even the well-to-do urban musicians were patronized and treated like servants. That the music made by rural gypsies, like Pano Grast, is not exactly, well, traditional, but like all music, keeps changing. And that the music heard by my parents may be unfashionable now, but that its power to move remains, and that in some respect qualifies it as folk music, if only because folk continue to listen to it and be moved by it.
I think one of the things that you find when you listen to a good gypsy band, there's a real innate nobility of style that they have, which springs just, I think, from pride of who they are.
I can tell you many things what I know about Hungarian gypsy music, and we can talking about exact music details, but the spirit looks like you cannot touch.
Yes, of course, there is gypsy musician spirit, not gypsy spirit. They are bohemians. That's gypsy spirit.
The potency of cheap music is earned at a high price. The potency of cheap music always comes at a cost. The just beyond the law, the sneak thief, the not nice, the look in the eyes of the hungry, the desperate, the lost, the famous virtuoso, the lord on his own land,
the small-time braggart calling the gypsy from his hut, the brilliant orchestration, the fury of the band, the order, play my tune, boy, the order, stand, now squat, fill up the place with music, sink down to your knees. OK, boys, get us singing, perform your proper parts, go serenade the ladies by playing from the trees, tender your cheap music to our expensive hearts. From restaurant and cafe, from villages and slums, from tongs and bones to fiddles, to concert halls and flags, the music starts out cheap, from churns and cheeks and drums, from rags to velvet coaches, then back again to rags. And under it, the simplest music of no choice, from slammer to slum party to simperings of strings, it's always the bare clamour of finger, fist and voice, and always the band waiting like servants in the wings.